I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Debbie Travis joins me now. She is the author of a fascinating, frank, and funny memoir about parenthood, Not Guilty, My Guide to Working Hard, Raising Kids, and Laughing Through the Chaos. She is the author of 8 best-selling books and an internationally syndicated column. She's produced 3 highly successful television series, Debbie Travis's The Painted House, Debbie Travis's Facelift, and From the Ground Up. She lives in Montreal, but joins me from here in Vancouver this day. She writes in Not Guilty about raising 2 boys while producing television, writing, and more. Random House is the publisher of Not Guilty, which retails for $29.95. DebbieTravis.com is the website. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Debbie Travis. Good morning, Ms. Travis.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Your grandfather invented the gummy bear?
He did. Oh, I forgot about that. I put it in the book. It's my claim to fame. I think it was my great-grandfather, actually. My father died when I was very young, but his family owned a candy factory in the north of England, an old kind of real Victorian mill that made the big urns, the big cauldrons that boiled sweets, and they used to make the sweets and the machines for people like Mars and Roundtree and Cadbury, and you know, that's why Brits have very bad teeth, including me. And it was, you know, it was like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory for a young girl.
I'll bet, yeah.
Yeah, so that was my claim to fame.
About your childhood in Britain, there's a wonderful story in the book about you were in Mr. Patel's store.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess there was a little box or something where people dropped coins in. And
well, they had in England at the time, you know, this is the unpolitically correct, 60s. And, you know, the book is full of kind of stories and antidotes with a kind of message there about, you know, today's bringing up of children and how strict, you know, and kind of maybe moral our parents were at the time. And they used to have this boy in every store called the Cripple, and it was a life-sized small boy on braces. There were a lot of children in the 50s and 60s, I guess, end of the polio years, who had these irons on their legs. And it was a charity. There was a hole at the back, and you put your pennies in, and it went to the charity. And I used to, with my girlfriend, you know, at about 7 years old, we had this great way of getting our hand into the back of it and stealing the money, and we often did this. And then one day we were caught counting all the pennies out on my bedroom floor by my mother, the tyrant, and immediately we're kind of frog marched down to where I was, the girl was sent home, down to the shop, and you know, had to give the money back. But instead of leaving it there, you know, poor Mr. Patel was probably so dying to get me out of the shop and didn't want me in there anyway. But my mother made me clean his windows every Saturday for the next month. So it was beyond humiliating, but I never stole a penny again. It was like, you know, it's all those lessons learned that we all have. And, you know, the point of the book is to get people to remember. And it was hard at first to remember these stories, but once you do, you know, they all start gushing back, and we all have them.
And did you do the similar, like, did you humiliate your kids as the way that your mother did?
Probably not quite as badly. You know, there was very much this kind of pull your socks up type of attitude, you know, where I was brought up. But I think a little bit of dose of humiliation, you know, is good for a child, you know, embarrass them a wee bit. And I've used it, you know, to threaten them over the years. There's a story in the book about we were going to Spain on holiday. My father, you know, lived there my stepfather for quite a long time. And the kids were, there were some other families going, and their children had a little bit more leeway. I think mine were a little younger, and they kept asking what time they could come in at night. And they were probably about 14 or 15. And I said, you know, you've got to be home by 12 o'clock. It was like a little village, and the kids would hang out. And they said, but, you know, it's not fair. Everybody else, you know. And this went on for like 2 months, and it was really driving us, you know, crazy. But also, when the children were small, and we used to go to Spain, you know, everybody goes topless on the beach. So we were on the plane, and one of the kids came over and must have had a terrible thought and said, you're not going to go topless, are you? Anyway, I said nothing. I said, go back to your seat. You know, 5 minutes later, the other one came in and was like, you know, Mum, it's really not fair. Why do we have to come in earlier than everybody else? So I had a brainwave, and I said, listen, you come in 1 minute after 12 o'clock, and I can guarantee I will be playing volleyball with your father, start naked, on the beach the next day. Well, I'll tell you, they were in at 12 o'clock every day. So a little bit of that, you know, you have to use what weapons you can with raising kids.
What kind of father is your husband, Hans?
I think he's a good dad. He, you know, I think a lot of fathers go through different periods when they maybe find, you know, parenting maybe easier. And I don't think he was that great when they were small. He was, I think he was a bit frightened of them. You know, it was all very overwhelming, and mothers seem to jump into this so easily. And I would say he's much closer to them now. They tend to, as young men, really, you know, talk to him much more than they talk to me. And, you know, he's taken them both away for, I don't know where they go, but, you know, for a few days at a time, you know, when my other son was 15, who's really into World War II, he took him across Germany and Poland, and they went to all the camps and stuff. It was like a real fun holiday. I'd rather go to the spa. Yeah. But they had a magnificent time. They could eat and drink and fart whenever they wanted, and they thought it was the best holiday they ever had. So, you know, I think dads have just as tough a time today, and often feel a little bit, maybe their, you know, their roles is taken over by us, you know, very organized, bossy women.
Talk to me about being a woman and being a mother. I mean, the struggle between staying at home and working. Did you think you struck a balance?
It's a great question, because this is the, you know, the book is called Not Guilty, and this is the number one thing that women today are really feeling, you know, guilty about. And it's like you can't win. We've asked for it all, we're doing it all, and we're very lucky. A lot of women can choose, do I go to work or do I stay at home? And it doesn't matter which one you do, you're feeling guilty. I should have been at this concert, I should have been here, I should have been, in the sandbox, or I should be running my career. You know, we're not very good at accepting what we've got, and the point of this book is to say, you know, a lot of that guilt is such a waste of time, because your kids are going to be who your kids are going to be. All they really need is your attention and a hug. And even if you're a stay-at-home mom, it doesn't always mean your headspace is there. You're sitting with your child and you're on your BlackBerry. You're not with your child. So I'm just trying to say to moms, as a mother who is maybe towards the finish line, the only advice I can really give is to say, you know, Don't sweat this small stuff. You know, your kids are going to just be fine. You're a great mom. And, you know, the guilt thing, it causes a lot of wasted energy.
Your kids, your two boys, Max and Josh, how old are they now?
They're 20 and 21, both bleeding me dry. They're both at university, stealing my furniture and drinking their way through these latter years.
Talk to me about your own childhood. You grew up a very British disposition, very British home. Was there a distance between your father had died early?
Yeah, you know.
Was there a distance between you and your mother and your stepfather?
There was definitely between my stepfather. With my mother, there was that very British, you know, like pat on the back. And it doesn't, you know, I don't think I ever remember my mother saying I love you. It doesn't mean she doesn't. You know, it just meant that it was all a little bit too uncomfortable. It was a little bit too close. And, you know, my kids, you know, it's what's so fantastic about this generation. They are more open, and all kids are today. You know, like, bye, Mom, love you. And they'll say it in front of four of their friends. They really don't think anything of it. Where I think with my mother, it was like if you got a little bit too close, you know, you would have all kind of fallen apart. And maybe that's coming out of, you know, Victorian era and then two world wars and a little bit more kind of standoffish. And then when my father died when I was 12 and she remarried when I was about 14, and I took that, I was a horrendous, sulky, horrible teenager. And I was atrocious. I mean, you know, he's a very nice man and, you know, he's great with my kids today, but I think I changed my name, and I called him Mr. Travis till I was 17, you know, and shook his hand at night, whereas the other kids were younger, and it's very tough, between the ages of 12 and I think 16, if something traumatic like that happens, it's very hard on any child, you know, because you're very self-conscious, and I think the hardest thing was just changing my name, or teachers can be incredibly cruel, and you know, they'd say things like, I'm sorry, what is your name today? You know, or you know, you'd live in dread of somebody saying, what does your dad do? You know, because you didn't have one. And maybe children don't have that as much today, but there were very few parents divorced. There was, you know, you hate being unusual, you hate standing out from the crowd.
Did you? How old were you when you went into modeling?
Well, it was anything to get you know, away from the house, and I just wanted to leave home, so I left home young. I guess around 16, 17. And I was old, believe me, Ben.
Yeah. There's a moment in the book where you discuss what your mother said to you about your looks and what your grandmother said to you about your looks.
Well, you know, again, Brits tend not to be very good at slapping you on the back because, you know, the north of England is like, well, we don't want you to get a big head type of thing. So I had a very powerful grandmother, and my mum was pretty tough. And my mother used to say, you know, you're not very pretty. All you've got is your brains. And my grandmother used to say, you know, you're not very clever. All you've got is your looks. So it would be like a Dr. Phil show, I think, about why I have no confidence.
But how did that affect that in terms of talking to your own kids?
Well, I think, well, with me, what it did with me constantly being pushed aside, you know, when you come from a big family, you do crave attention, and you know, I never really got it. It was always like, yeah, very nice, you know, Mum, I'm on a billboard in the village, and it's like, yeah, that's nice, you know, go and feed your brother. And I think what it did with me was make me want attention more, and maybe that's all I'm doing in Canada, is trying to get somebody to say well done. But with my boys, yeah, I've never gone over the top with self-esteem, because I feel today that we're going a little bit too far, telling our children every 20 seconds they're the most brilliant thing in the world. But, you know, my kids would get a good mark at school, and I'd usually say they'd cheated. But you know, yeah, I tried to be much better. I think we all try to be better than our parents, and you know, try and take the best of what they did, and try not to turn into your mothers. Well, I think most of us do. But I'd try to be a bit more real. You know, if they were the worst hockey player, I'd say, I don't think you should be doing this. I think you should take up the violin. You know, because sometimes it's just a waste of time, you know.
And kids need to be competitive, you find?
I think they need to be competitive. I think boys definitely need to do sports, any type of sport, or if they end up, you know, damaging your house. It's a personal thing with everybody, and I don't think you can ever tell children enough how much you love them. That's a different thing. But when you've got, you know, a little fat girl and you're telling her that, yes, she's the best ballet dancer in the world, you know what? It's not real. And this is why we have a problem with kids, you know, going into the workforce today, because they've been told by everybody that they're brilliant and they don't want to do the jobs of you know, going through the ranks and rising up the ladder. They want to have it all now. So I think we have created a few little monsters. I think it's changing again, though.
Did you sort of wish that you had a daughter?
Oh, yeah. Well, my husband does. Yeah. You know, but I was brought up with, you know, sisters as well, and I saw the damage we did to each other. One of my sisters still has a cauliflower ear that would look very well on a rugby player, that I did. I was very happy to have boys, but it's very different. And it was a challenge in the book to talk about girls, because I don't know girls very well until, of course, your teenagers turn up in your house. Because, you know, you go through this stage where suddenly the girls start arriving. And it's very funny because, you know, you get the boys getting ready all day and the hair's being done and everything. And then all these girls turn up. And it lasts about 5 minutes, because once the girls turn up, the boys don't know what to do with them. And then they all end up, all the boys in one room and all the girls in the other. And you're stuck with them. And you're like, you know, why don't you talk to them? It's like, well, we've got nothing in common. Of course, that changes into other stuff a couple of years later. But I got to know girls then. And they're way more complicated. They're way more conniving. They just see the world in a far more complex way. You know, whereas boys are black and white. And, you know, they just beat each other up and then get on with it.
There's a story in the book when you'd started painting people's houses, and you went in overalls, I guess, while you were on a job to pick up your son.
Oh, every day, yeah.
At school. And I guess one of the women that you were working for was picking up her own son at the same school.
Oh, yeah. And she said, you know, it was a quite a good, you know, boys' private school, and she was really quite upset, and she asked me, you know, what I was doing at the school, and was I painting it? And I said, no, you know, my kids go here, and they were small at the time. And she was so offended. She looked like, you know, I said, well, you know, they were digging the roads or something. And you know, again, this is women not supporting women, and I had wonderful people who helped me, but There was more other mothers who were scathing, and you'd be in the newspaper because you'd done something, and they would say, you know, well, how are your kids handling this? You know, always with that little knife going in of, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't be out there having a career or painting people's houses or whatever you're doing. And I see that every day, that women not supporting each other. And you know, it just adds to the guilt. And there's no need for it, because we should be really lucky of where we are today, that we can have, you know, those choices. I mean, maybe you don't. Maybe you have to, you know, go to work to put money on the table. But there are mums who could say, you know, well, maybe I'll stay at home for the first few years.
And that woman, whatever happened to her?
Oh, I poked her eyes out. No. you know, well, listen, today they all want to be your friends. You know, suddenly you're really successful and everybody's, oh, yeah, I was there at the beginning, but I'm sure she's...
Who's the woman that went on to work for you?
Actually, that woman, yes. Years later, there was another woman who was really supportive and often would help and take the kids and stuff. And years later, she went through a terrible divorce, and I gave her a job, you know, in her late 50s, which is tough. So, you know, life goes around and around and around.
What sort of mother do you think your kids think of you as?
Dreadful, probably.
No,
they're just getting their lawsuits together now.
There's a note in the back there that they wrote, is that correct?
Yeah, well, the publisher was very funny, and she said, you know, it would be really good if they wrote a letter to their mother, you know, about what they thought of you and everything. Well, of course, it took them twice as long to write that, you know, two-paragraph letter than it did for me to write the whole book. And, you know, we were virtually going down the printing press, you know. And, you know, they kind of laughed about it. But you have to remember that children will remember something completely different. I mean, they said everything in the book is rubbish, you know, and they say the most silly things. And I don't think you appreciate your parents until you have your own children. But they've said things like, Mum, you were never on time at a soccer game. You always went to the wrong pitch. You always forgot the skates. No, you probably did those things once, but that is what they remember. They remember, I've probably had 5 fights with my husband in 20 years, and they remember every single one. I remember when you threw the cup at Dad, you hit him on the forehead. Well, those were the nice times when I was really nice to him. I think there were 3 times of that. But, you know, that's kids. You know, they will say terrible things and hurtful things. And they do. I mean, look at parents who are going through divorces. You know, the kids work the system, you know, and they're their own little people. So, you know, I think it's when they finally go through it themselves, and boy, I'm going to have such a good laugh, then I'm sure they're going to turn around and say, maybe you weren't so bad, Mom.
But besides the TV stuff, you do a lot of public speaking, and you talk to people. Mm. The audiences are predominantly women, I gather.
I talk a lot, you know, obviously years and years ago, I go across the country and talk about design and paint colors and things like that. But bit by bit, I got asked to talk at, you know, women in business, women, you know, trying to get things off the ground, women juggling. And it became, I really love it. And that was really how this book came about. Just kind of mentoring mums. I mean, I don't have the answers. I'm not particularly qualified. Well, I'm not qualified at all. But I've done it. The only qualification I've got is I've gone through the ranks, and you look back, and any mum will tell you, you know, listen, stop worrying about this stuff. They're going to be fine. They will all come out in the end. There's not that many serial killers out there, you know. And I just love really listening to mothers' questions, and I think they do feel maybe a little bit more inspired when they know you've sobbed yourself to sleep at night and you've told them your mistakes.
There's a story in the book, I guess, when you'd moved to London for the first time, you'd taken out an apartment, and I guess some Saudi Arabian family wanted it back.
Mm.
They gave you £3,000.
Right.
You write in the book that you still have the money in a bank account in England. How much is that worth now?
Probably $3,100. I'm not the best investor in the world. No, what that was somebody. I ended up living in a flat in a large house, and a Saudi family bought it as a hotel, and they had to get us out. And in those days, we had the sitting tenants law, and we actually asked for $300, and I think the guy didn't understand, and he gave me and my flatmate £3,000 each. But that lesson was really about every woman, I think, needs their backdoor money, that, you know, the I'm out of here money. And today, so many women haven't changed at all. And they really, you know, you've got to put something aside for yourself. You never know what's going to be around the corner. And, you know, I tell the story in the book of my mother. When my father was dying, she was 33. She had four children under 12 and a newborn baby. And the ambulance driver was taking him to the hospital, and he stopped outside my mum's bank and said, you know, do you have a bank account? And if you do, you need to go in and get your money. And there she was, you know, in the last breaths of her husband's life. And she went in, and I mean, we're not talking about a lot of money, but it kept us in school and it kept food on the table for the next 6 months. And that hasn't changed much. If your husband dies, he can, you know, the government can put your money in escrow, and it could be months before you see anything. And the same with divorce. You know, I have friends, I'm at the age where everybody's getting divorced, and you know, they're going from living in fabulous homes to very little, because they just didn't think it was going to happen. So I'm a great believer, even in the happiest marriage, is have that secret little bank account or a hole under the floorboards. And you talk to anybody over 70, any woman, and they'll tell you the same thing, you know. Tuck some money away, love. You never know what's going to happen.
It's been great having you on the program today, Debbie, and well done on this book.
Thank you.
Congratulations and continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
The book is called Not Guilty, My Guide to Working Hard, Raising Kids, and Laughing Through the Chaos. $29.95 from Random House. DebbieTravis.com is her website for the commentary. I'm Joseph Plante.